This is Case Closed, crime stories from the golden age of radio. Welcome back to Case Closed. Thanks for joining me this Wednesday. Our hour of crime begins with the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes this week. We'll hear the case of the Iron Box from December 31st, 1945. After that, it's the adventures of Philip Marlowe and the Seaside Sabbatical, his story from July 7th, 1951.
This episode from the life of Sherlock Holmes will be transmitted to our men and women overseas by shortwave and through the worldwide facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Petri Wine brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce and the new adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to Dr. Watson tell us another exciting adventure he shared with his old friend, that master detective, Sherlock Holmes. Well, this is it, New Year's Eve. And I wish you could be here with us this evening so we could toast each other with a glass of Petri California Port. As you know, port wine has long been a favorite wine for celebrating a happy occasion. That's because port is a wine rich in tradition. And you couldn't ask for a more delicious port than Petri Port. Petri Port is a deep, glowing red color, beautiful to look at and wonderful to taste, with a hearty, full flavor that's right from the heart of the grape. And when you serve Petri Port to your friends tonight or any time, remember you can serve it proudly because the name Petri is the proudest name in the history of American wines. And now I'm sure Dr. Watson's waiting for us, so let's drop in and see him. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Bartell. Drop your usual chair.
Thank you.
That's it. Well, did you enjoy the Christmas holidays?
Well, I've had a whale of a time, thank you, but I don't think I can face a turkey or a mince pie for at least another year. How about you, Doctor?
Oh, I had a very pleasant week, too, my boy. Parties, visitors, and a flattering number of Christmas messages to be answered.
Oh, say, you got a new pipe. Is that a Christmas present?
Yes, new pipe, new tobacco pouch, and a pound of my favorite tobacco. All of them sent to me from London by an old client and a friend of mine, Sir Ian Dunbar.
An old client, huh? Well, do you mean he was one of your patients, or was he someone that you and the great Sherlock Holmes helped?
The latter, Mr. Bartell. As a matter of fact, it was receiving this gift that reminded me of the story I've decided to tell you tonight. The story in which Sir Ian Dunbar played a prominent part.
And how did it begin?
The day before New Year's Eve in 1899, Sherlock Holmes and I sat in opposite corners of a first-class railway carriage as we sped towards Edinburgh in the Flying Scotsman.
What took you and Sherlock Holmes up there, Doctor?
It started off as a holiday visit, Mr. Bartell. My old friend Sir Walter Dunbar had asked Holmes and me to spend a few days with him at Dunbar Castle, about 20 miles outside Edinburgh. After we left King's Cross Station, Holmes, his sharp, eager face framed in his deerstalking cap, dipped into the bundle of fresh papers which he'd brought with him. We'd left Bedford far behind us before he thrust the last one of them under the seat, leaned across, and offered me his cigar case.
Care for a cigar, Watson?
No, thanks, awful. I'll stick to my pipe.
Flying Scotsman's living up to its name. We're going splendidly. Our present rate is 53.5 miles an hour.
Oh, I hadn't noticed the quarter-mile post.
Nor have I, but the telegraph posts on this line are 60 yards apart. With the aid of a watch, the calculation is a simple one. Watson, my dear fellow, we have several hours ahead of us. Tell me more about Sir Walter Dunbar. I have a feeling that he's in some kind of trouble, but you haven't wanted to talk about it.
Well, it's not exactly trouble, Holmes, but there's a strange problem that confronts the Dunbars. A problem... it'll be settled at midnight tomorrow.
Oh, indeed. Night of New Year's Eve, eh?
Yes, exactly. But to really appreciate the story, I have to begin by telling you of the death of old Sir Thomas Dunbar.
The father of the present baronet, I suppose.
Yes, he was severely wounded at Waterloo, though he managed to last out long enough to get back to Dunbar Castle. The story goes that as he lay there on his deathbed, he told his wife of his plans for their unborn child.
Dinna grieve, lass. I fetched a baronet's here home from Waterloo. What if I fetched a mortal wound as well? Oh, hush, lass. I'm no afraid to die. All that niggles me is that I shall ne'er see the child you bear. Is Sir Wattle Scott no coming yet? Can he visit the deathbed of his old friend? Who's there? Is that you, Sandy Murdoch?
Aye, Thomas. It's me.
Aye. I'm leaving an unborn son behind me when I die. Now, I don't trust women or children or banks for that matter. I put the best part of my wealth in gold in the big iron box you'll find under the bed. The money's there. Aye, and something else for a rainy day. You're to keep that box in trust for me, Sandy. You can turn it over to my boy on the New Year's Eve before his 21st birthday. And he'll be a man and wise enough to know how to use it. You understand, Sandy?
Aye, Thomas. But supposing your bairn's a girl?
A girl? I tell you, it'll be a boy. And we'll name him Walter after my good friend, Sir Walter Scott.
Very interesting story, Watson. And that child, of course, is the gentleman we are going to see now, Sir Walter Dunbar.
Exactly.
And the first baronet was a friend of Sir Walter Scott, while his son conversed of your acquaintance. Why, it's a family singularly rich in literary friendships.
That's not very funny, Holmes. To continue, I suppose you can guess what happened. Sir Thomas carefully drew up a document to specify. The New Year's Eve before the baronet's 21st birthday. And the poor child was born on February 29th. It was a leap year.
So poor Sir Walter is still waiting for his iron box full of gold.
Yes, he'll be 84 next year, and yet legally, with only one birthday every 4 years in the eyes of the law, he'll at last be 21.
A most amusing situation, though I'm afraid Sir Walter finds it far from entertaining. The lawyers must have been extremely scrupulous in abiding by the letter of the document.
Yes, old Sandy Murdoch is dead now, of course, but he too is a great-grandson, William Murdoch, who still handles the Dunbar estate. He'll be at the castle tonight to formally hand over the iron box.
I'm delighted you accepted the holiday invitation of Sir Walter. My dear fellow, I've needed a rest, but I've always loathed too strict a one. This situation may pose a nice little problem for me.
Problem?
Yes, I'm reasonably certain that the aged Sir Walter Dunbar will not get his iron box full of gold on this New Year's Eve either. But we shall see, old fellow. We shall see.
Dr. Watson, I'm glad to see you and Mr. Holmes here at the castle.
Thank you, my boy. Holmes, this is Ian Dunbar, Sir Walter's grandson.
How do you do, Mr. Dunbar?
I'm very proud to meet you, Mr. Holmes. I've heard a lot about you. Our grandfather will be down in a few moments. Let's go into the library, shall we?
Well, I imagine Sir Walter's quite excited about tonight's ceremony, isn't he?
Wouldn't you be? If you'd waited 63 years too long for an inheritance.
Indeed, I should.
Thank the Lord I had the foresight to be born on the prosaic date of August the 21st.
In the event of your grandfather's death, you would be the next baronet, I take it.
Yes, Mr. Holmes. You see, my father was killed 2 months ago at Mafeking.
Yes, I read about it in the papers, my boy. I'm very sorry.
Thank you, Doctor. The opening of the box isn't going to be the only ceremony at midnight. Dorothy and I are announcing our engagement.
Dorothy
Small. She and her father are staying here, too.
My congratulations.
Yes, indeed, Ian. Indeed, mine, too.
Thank you. It's been quite a battle with her father, though. He's a businessman and isn't impressed with titles, when they aren't accompanied by a suitable income. But when we told him about the inheritance, he relented and gave his consent. Ah, here's Dorothy now. Dorothy, darling, I want you to meet two friends of mine. Mr. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson.
How do you do?
Now, how do you do, Miss Ball?
How are you, my dear? From what this young man's been telling us, I gather that congratulations are in order.
Thank you. I finally persuaded Father that Ian would make a worthy son-in-law. For a while, I was afraid we'd have to elope to Gretna Green, live in a cottage on bread and cheese and love, and brave the parental wrath, just as they do in the storybooks.
Oh, Sir Walter, there you are.
Watson, my dear boy, how are you? And this must be your friend Sherlock Holmes.
How do you do, Sir Walter?
Very well for a young nipper who'll be 21 at midnight. gentlemen, may I introduce Mr. Herbert Smollett?
How do you do, sir? I believe that we have to congratulate you on the engagement of your daughter.
That was supposed to remain a secret until midnight. Mm-hmm. The Dunbar box was finally opened.
Dinner be grouchy, Herbert. The children are in love, and I'm going to settle money on Ian. And it's New Year's Eve. Let's enter into the spirit of the occasion. Bring out the glasses, Ian. I've had some bottles of my special pride put out. It's the finest port in Scotland. The cream of Dunbar. My father laid the first bottle down the year before I was born. And a drink of the brew will surely warm the cockles of your heart.
My mouth's watering already, Sir Walter.
When is this lawyer fellow, young Murdoch, getting here?
Oh, any moment, Herbert. As soon as he arrives, we'll have dinner, and then we'll be ready for the evening ceremonies.
He's bringing the famous iron box with him, Sir Walter?
If he doesn't, he won't get any dinner, Holmes. Ian, pass the glasses around, my boy. Ah, there you are, Murdoch.
Good evening, Sir Walter.
Oh, you've got the box with you, I see. Now the party's complete. Oh, let me introduce you. Miss Small, her father, Mr. Small, my grandson, Ian, you know. Mr. Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson.
How do you do, sir? I'm sorry I'm late, Sir Walter. My train was delayed.
Oh, that's all right, Murdoch. You're here, and you brought the box. That's all that matters. Ian, give our young lawyer a drink. Here, I'll help you pour it.
I must say that this is rather exciting, Holmes. The famous iron box with its inheritance of gold.
Yes, and from the size of the box, of a rough guess, I should estimate its cubic content in gold at around 5,000 pounds. Not a vast sum, perhaps, to a businessman like Mr. Small, but a windfall to an impecunious Scottish baronet.
Yes, I suppose it is.
A strong young man, Mr. Murdoch.
How do you mean strong, Holmes?
A box that size, full of golden sovereigns, would weigh a considerable amount. And yet the lawyer carried it single-handed.
And now that we're all assembled, I'm going to propose a toast. Though it's still some hours off yet, let's drink to the new year. It means a lot to some of us. To 1900!
1900! We should toast more than just 1900, Sir Walter. We should drink to the new century that's about to begin.
Good idea, Dorothy.
Oh, I'm afraid that wouldn't be quite appropriate, Miss Small. To be accurate, the 20th century won't begin until January the 1st, 1901, and not 1900.
Of course. That's it. Dorothy, I'm afraid your wedding can't take place for some time yet.
Father, what are you talking about?
I read an article in The Guardian the other day that said just the same thing as you, Dr. Watson. And what's more, it said something even more important. It said that 1900 is not a leap year.
Oh, rubbish. Leap year comes every 4 years. There was one in 1896, then obviously 1900 is one.
I think Mr. Small may be right. What do you say, Mr. Holmes? Do you know?
Well, I hope no one would bring up this point, but it's the little problem I referred to on the train, my dear Watson.
What do you remember?
Holmes, for heaven's sake, answer. Is 1900 a leap year or no?
I'm afraid it's not, Sir Walter.
No?
Because of a slight imbalance that would otherwise be produced in the calendar. Of the even century years, only those divisible by 400 are leap years. In other words, 1600 was a leap year, the year 2000 will be a leap year, but 1800 and 1900 are not leap years.
Then you have no birthday next year, Sir Walter, and I'm afraid I can't open the box tonight.
And the Dunbars won't get their inheritance.
And you, my dear, don't marry for a few more years. I won't allow you to marry a pauper.
Mr. Holmes, are you sure of your facts?
I'm very much afraid that I am, young man.
Oh. This is terrible. I can't stand any more.
No, don't take it too badly, Sir Walter. Here, drink this. That's it, after all. You only have to wait another 4 years.
Another 4 years? At my age, young man, at my age. Oh, no, I shall never live that long. Hey, what is it, Angus?
Dinner is prepared, Sir Walter. We can serve it as soon as you're ready, sir.
What a miserable meal, Holmes. Sir Walter's gone to his room. The young lovers are nearly in tears. And Small and the lawyer Murdoch seem to be positively gloating.
Yes, a most depressing atmosphere in which to welcome the new year. But let us, at least, make the best of it. I think I'll go and have a talk with Sir Walter. And you, my dear chap, why not try and cheer up the young folks? Some of your experiences in India may make them take their minds off
the trouble. Yes, quite an idea. I'll join you in the library. Call me if you want me, Holmes. Ah, there you are, my dear.
Hello, Dr. Watson.
All alone in front of the fire, eh?
I'm afraid we're not in very good spirits, sir.
Oh, nevertheless, I'll sit down here and join you, if you don't mind. Misery loves company, you know.
You're very kind, Doctor.
Oh, not at all.
I was just trying to persuade Ian to elope with me. But he's being most ungallant. He won't even consider it.
How can I, darling? I've got under 200 pounds a year in my own right. How could we live on that? I was counting on the money the grandfather was going to give us to get me started.
Now, Miss Small, a little earlier, you talked of Gretna Green and bread and cheese and love in a cottage. Yes, there's a lot to be said for it, you know.
To be said for it, yes, Doctor. But have you ever tried it?
Not literally, my boy, but I may tell you that when Mary, my wife, and I were first married, I had very little money. In fact, my income was just about the sum that you mentioned. And we were very happy.
Ah, but you have a profession, Doctor. Look at me. I've been trained for nothing except to be Laird of Dunbar Castle. I can't support a wife on tradition.
But you're young, Ian. You can get some kind of position. I'm sure you can.
Yes, of course. As a matter of fact, I think that... Holmes, what is it? What's wrong?
There's devil's work afoot, Watson. Come with me, old fellow. And you, Mr. Dunbar.
Mr. Holmes, what's happened?
It's Sir Walter. I went to his room. It was in darkness, but in the moonlight I saw two figures struggling by the open casement. One of them was Sir Walter. As I entered, he disappeared from sight. His attacker had pushed him out of the window into the moat.
How dreadful.
The other man got away in the darkness. We must get lanterns and go out to the moat at once. Though I'm very much afraid, Mr. Dunbar, that your grandfather is beyond our help.
Dr. Watson will be back in just a second, so I'd just like to remind you that if you want to serve a wine over the holidays that you're sure the ladies will enjoy, serve Petri California Muscatel. Petri Muscatel is a golden wine with a wonderful flavor, the flavor of big, plump muscat grapes. And you know what a flavor that is. I'm sure you'll find that Petri Muscatel is the favorite wine of all women, just as Petri Port is the favorite wine with men. And incidentally, if you're not sure which to get, Petri Muscatel or Petri Port, don't buy one, buy two. Get them both, and you'll be sure to please everyone. Now, to get back to our story, someone had pushed poor old Sir Walter out of his bedroom window and into the moat below. Isn't that right, Dr. Watson?
Yes, Mr. Bartell. Of course, we grabbed lanterns as fast as we could and rushed outside, but it was a hopeless task. The water was 8 or 10 feet deep, and it seemed obvious that the elderly Sir Walter wouldn't have a chance of saving himself. But we searched on, the flicker of bobbing lanterns and the scurrying figures in the frosty moonlight, forming a weird, fantastic battle.
Angus, bring a lantern over here.
Aye, sir.
Can you see anything, Holmes? Not a thing.
I don't see why your friend doesn't call the police, Dr. Watson. He's accomplishing nothing.
He thought there might be a chance of finding the old man alive, Mr. Small. He wants to avoid a scandal, if possible, for your sake, sir, as well as the Dunbar.
The scandal can't touch me or Dorothy over this. Her engagement was never announced, thank heaven.
That's a great pity, sir. I should think some new blood in your family would be a great improvement.
You're being confoundedly impertinent,
and
Doctor.
And you'll be confoundedly heartless, sir. Well, Holmes, have you given up hope?
I'm afraid we'll never find him without dragnets and grappling hooks. I have to call the police. What time is it? Sir Ian, you know the time?
What did you call me, Mr. Holmes?
Sir Ian.
By Jove, yes. It does seem a bit premature, Holmes, but of course you're right. If your poor grandfather's dead, Mr. Dunbar, you're the baronet now.
And the time, Sir Ian? It's a quarter to 12, Mr. Holmes.
A quarter of an hour to the new year. Sir Ian, doesn't that fact suggest something to you?
Yes. Yes, it does. So I'm the new baronet, am I? Very well, then. There'll be no more talk of the police for 15 minutes. I want all of you to come back to the castle with me. As the last chime of midnight rings out, I shall have a statement to make. A statement that I want you all to hear.
Oh, what's he brought us all back here for, Holmes? There's something very funny going on. I tell you, I don't like the look of it.
And I, Watson, like the look of it very much.
I wish you wouldn't be so dashed mysterious. What are you up to? You haven't taken a step yet towards finding the murderer.
Haven't I? And I wonder what causes the beads of perspiration on Mr. Small's brow.
Small? You mean that Small...
Yes, and I wonder what causes the singular look of apprehension on the face of Murdoch, the young lawyer. You remember, of course, on my remarking how easily he carried the large iron box.
Good Scott, yes. And it took a strong man to throw Sir Walter out of the window.
Shh, Watson. Huh? The new year is approaching.
Ladies and gentlemen, in view of our recent tragedy, this is one New Year's Eve when none of us feels like song and jollity. But there still remains a ritual duty for me to perform. Mr. Murdoch, open the iron box, please.
But I can't do that. It was only to be opened for your grandfather.
No, Mr. Murdoch. The phrase was that it was to be opened on the New Year's Eve before the baronet's 21st birthday. I am now the baronet, and I shall be 21 next year on August 21st. Open the box, please, Mr. Murdoch.
Ian, darling, how frightfully clever of you.
Good lad, I hoped you'd think of it.
Sir Ian.
Murdoch, open that box.
Very well, Sir Ian. But I'm afraid you're in for something of a shock.
Oh, great, Scott, the box is empty.
Except for a sheet of notepaper in the bottom.
What's the meaning of this, Murdoch?
Read that paper, Sir Ian, and you'll understand.
I owe you 4,000 sovereigns. And it's signed Alexander Murdoch, on behalf of Murdoch and Murdoch, lawyers. You'd better explain this.
It's the family skeleton, Sir Ian. That note is signed by my great-grandfather, the one that witnessed the original deed concerning the box. As soon as Sir Walter was born on that February the 29th, my great-grandfather realized the money wouldn't have to be produced for 84 years.
And so he stole it.
He borrowed it. He always intended to pay it back, but he was never able to. When he died, he told my father of his secret, and my father in turn told me. We've always planned to put back the money, Sir Ian, but we've never been able to.
This is daylight robbery. You should prosecute them, Ian. The firm's still in business. You can ruin them. You can sue them for every penny they have.
Mr. Small, you've already shown a marked aversion to my family. I suggest you allow me to handle their affairs.
Bravo, Ian.
How dare you, Dorothy? Go to your room.
No one's going to their room. No one's leaving here until the police arrive. I'm convinced that one of you murdered my grandfather tonight.
And if you ask me, it's obvious who that someone is.
Who, Dr. Watson?
You, Mr. Murdoch. You came here planning to kill poor old Sir Walter because you never intended to open that box. You thought that your secret would die with him.
That's a lie. I was going to tell him everything and then ask for time to pay the money. I didn't kill him.
Of course he didn't. There's your murderer. You yourself, Ian.
Father, what are you saying?
I'm saying that Ian's the murderer. He saw that the box wasn't going to be open for another 4 years. He realized out the money couldn't marry Dorothy, so he killed his grandfather and then ordered the box opened.
You're trying to cover yourself. You pushed grandfather out of that window tonight. You thought that if he died, the box would never be opened, so Dorothy couldn't marry me.
You young whippersnapper.
Gentlemen, please.
Upon my soul, Holmes, you seem remarkably calm.
Do I, my dear Watson? I must say I'm absolutely fascinated by listening to three people accusing each other of murder, and each of them producing perfectly sound motives. It's a remarkable example of the dangers of reasoning from motive alone. We should profit by experience, Watson.
Mr. Holmes, how can you be so calm? There's a murderer in this room.
I suppose this game of charades is getting a little out of hand, Miss Small. Let's conclude it. You'd better come out now.
That tapestry, it's moving.
A happy new year to you all.
Grandfather. Sir Walter, how am I seeing a ghost?
Oh, Sir Walter, you're all right.
But what kind of a game have you been playing?
It's a bonny game that Holmes and I invented. You might call it forcing the issue. I was determined to have the box open before the next 4 years were out, whilst I was still alive to look inside it. But the trickery of your family, Murdoch, has made me a very unhappy man.
Sir Walter, I shall pay back the money in a few years. I swear I will.
It'll be too late to do me any good. But I'll take care that Ian gets it. I've half a mind to prosecute you.
Grandfather, the money isn't important now that you're all right.
You were counting on it just the same, my boy, so that you could marry Dorothy. I know that.
She'll never marry a pauper. I won't allow it.
When I'm 21, you can't stop me, Father. And I am going to marry Ian.
Be quiet. Sir Walter, this is a very unsavory business. I think that you owe us an explanation of your behavior tonight.
You tell him, Holmes. I fancy a wee drop of cream of Dunbar. Watching you all search for my body in the moat has made me thirsty.
The explanation is a very simple one, ladies and gentlemen. When you arrived here tonight, Mr. Murdoch, I knew from the way you handled the box that it could not contain the sum of gold it was supposed to.
And so you suspected fraud and devised a plan to force the opening of the box, huh?
Yes, and Sir Walter was an eager conspirator.
Of course I was. Ian is 21 next August. Supposing I had died after he came of age and before my next birthday, 4 years hence, the box would never have been opened.
And so we invented the fake murder story. By the way, Ian,
I must congratulate you for grasping the possibilities of the situation so speedily. If you hadn't demanded the opening of the box, the Murdoch secret might still be a secret.
Well, it was a clever plan, Holmes. It's too bad that it had to have such a miserable ending.
I'm not sure that we have finished with the matter. Mr. Murdoch.
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
You say that your family took £4,000 from that box?
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
Curious. I would have sworn from its size that it would hold closer to £5,000. And in your account of the legend, Watson, you told me that Sir Thomas Dunbar stated on his deathbed that he had put something else in the box.
Yes, right.
Something for a rainy day, is that
yes.
it? Mm-hmm. Did the Murdochs find that extra something?
No, Mr. Holmes. They found nothing but the gold.
Now, that's very odd. I think I'll take a closer look at that box, if you don't mind.
Since this seems to be a night of telling secrets, I think you might as well know, Father, that if you don't give your consent, I shall elope with you.
Oh, bravo, my dear, bravo.
No such thing.
I admire your resolution, young lady, but I hardly think it will be necessary.
What do you mean, Holmes?
Permit me to show you all the treasure of the Dunbars.
What have you found, Holmes?
The something for a rainy day that old Sir Thomas spoke of. You see, since the cubic contents of the box obviously differed from my calculations, I deduced the existence of a false bottom. I was correct. And in that space, I found this.
Oh, it's a manuscript.
Quite so, the manuscript of a book. Look at the title page and see the author's name.
A History of the Dunbar Family by Sir Walter Scott.
I think, Sir Walter, that an original and unpublished manuscript by your distinguished namesake will prove worth several times the gold that is missing from that box.
You've saved the day for us, Holmes, my boy. God bless you. Oh, this has been a stranger new year as ever I knew. But it's turned out to be a bonny one, thanks to you, Holmes. Well, fill up your glasses. We're going to drink a toast to the new year.
By Joe, yes, Sir Walter. This is really a happy occasion.
Then let's complete it by singing the traditional song of the season, Auld Lang Syne. And in this case, when we sing Should Old Acquaintance Be Forgot, I feel that in our hearts we should be thinking of Sir Walter Scott. Though he died over 60 years ago, he's made us all very happy here tonight.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to
Doctor, that turned out to be a very happy new year for all concerned.
Yes, that's one new year that I'll never forget.
Well, I sure hope you'll always remember this one, too.
Oh, just a second, my boy. That calls for a glass of port.
Fine.
To a happy new year, my boy, for you and for our many friends listening in.
And to you, Doctor.
Oh, thanks, boy.
That's good. Doctor, this has indeed been a pleasant association for me.
Oh, I'm glad to hear.
You're the best storyteller I've ever known, and the Petri family makes the best wine I've ever tasted. I hope that, just as they've been making wine for generations in the past, the Petri family will continue to make fine wine in the future.
And Mr. Bartell, I know that you'll always be here to tell us just how good that Petri wine is.
Well, I hope so, Doctor. And I hope you'll always be right here beside me to tell another swell story about Mr. Holmes.
I hope so too, my boy.
Oh, and incidentally, Doctor, what new adventure are you planning to tell us next week?
Next week, Mr. Bartell, I'm going to tell you a weird story. It starts with a series of murders on Hampstead Heath and ends with a battle to the death in a burning waxworks. I call it The Strange Case of the Murderer in Wax.
Tonight's Sherlock Holmes adventure was written by Dennis Green and Anthony Boucher and was suggested by an incident in the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story, The Silver Blaze. Music is by Dean Fossler. Mr. Rathbone appears through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Mr. Bruce through the courtesy of Universal Pictures, where they are now starring in the Sherlock Holmes series. Petri Wine Company of San Francisco, California, invite you to tune in again next week, same time, same station, Sherlock Holmes comes to you from our Hollywood studio. This is Harry Bartell saying goodnight for the Petri family. For a solid hour of exciting mystery dramas, listen every Monday on most of these same stations at 8 o'clock to Michael Shane, followed immediately by Sherlock Holmes. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
We delay the start of our scheduled program. We have delayed the start of our scheduled program to bring you a bulletin from CBS News. Two helicopters carrying the United Nations ceasefire team left Kaesong shortly before 9 o'clock Sunday morning Korean time. Communist officers are already in Kaesong to participate in the preliminary ceasefire talks. This bulletin has come to you from CBS News. We now resume our scheduled program.
Most Saturdays at this time, we spend an exciting half hour of adventure and action with America's public hero number one, Hopalong Cassidy. Well, even two-fisted cowboys take summer vacations when they can, and Hoppy is no exception. Hopalong and Topper will be back with us riding the CBS air trails again 11 weeks from tonight, September 22nd.
Get this and get it straight. Crime is a sucker's road, and those who travel it wind up in the gutter, the prison of the grave. There's no other end, but they never learn.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character in The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. Now, with Gerald Moore starred as Philip Marlowe, we bring you tonight's exciting story, A Seaside Sabbatical.
Wire in my hand said it all. Need your help, urgent. Meet me at 8:30 tonight, Ship's Galley Cafe, Long Beach. Signed, Dale Higgins. The time and the place were known factors. The need for help, the urgency, and most of all, Dale Higgins were unknown. And my hazy recollection of algebra told me that three unknowns are mathematically impossible to find. Call it a challenge. Call it money. Call it a chance for a shore dinner. Call it anything you like. But 8:15 found me pulling into a parking lot on Ocean Boulevard. Not far from the amusement pier.
Just leave it there. Be right with you.
Oh, hello, Mr. Marlowe.
Hiya, Red. How's it going?
Oh, great, thanks. What brings you to the capital of Iowa?
Corn. My aim's getting bad, Red. I thought I'd come down to the pike and try for my limit at a shooting gallery.
Gee, really?
Yeah. Greatest practice in the world. Is it still 35 cents and no questions asked?
Huh? Oh, to park the car. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, kid, keep it.
Oh, thanks. Hey, I mind if I recommend the Quick Quack?
How's that again?
Used to be the Dead Duck. Best shooting gallery on the pike for my dough.
Oh, that Quick Quack. Oh, sure. Anybody be a fool to go anywhere else,
yeah,
huh?
My sentiments exactly.
See you, Red.
You bet, Mr. Marlowe.
Red's a nice kid. His name was a natural. He was blonde. I bobbed along Ocean Boulevard in a direction that instinct and a blaring blue neon sign indicated would lead me on course to the Ship's Galley. The night was muggy and close. You wore it like an extra coat, and the ocean breeze I'd anticipated had retired in favor of alternate waves of fog that rolled in, engulfed you for a moment, and then suddenly rolled out again. I was very nearly on time for my 8:30 appointment with Dale Higgins, as I turned blue beneath the Ship's Galley neon and stepped inside to be greeted by tight little groups of faces that opened and closed to admit food, drink, and talk. All indigo. The door behind me closed on two thoughts. My dreams of a shore dinner were blasted, and the Ship's Galley emerged as the last place in the world for anyone in need of urgent help to discuss his problems. But then, I didn't know Dale Higgins.
Are you Philip Marlowe, by any chance?
That's right.
Yeah, it looked like you were looking for someone. I'm Higgins.
Oh, how are you, Higgins? Do we talk here?
Probably not very well.
No.
Walk along the beach?
Oh, fine. Now, say, Higgins, did you ever wonder why people pack into hot little rooms on a night like this?
Oh, you mean the Ship's Galley?
Yeah.
Well, philosophy is not my business, Marlowe.
What is?
Well, I don't quite know how to tell you, I guess.
Well, your wire said urgent. That's good enough for openers.
Yes, well, the truth is, I was a little quick sending that wire.
Oh?
Pretty upset about a situation at the time, but things have resolved themselves now, and I won't require any help.
Uh-huh. Well, you ought to know.
I expect to pay you, of course, the trip down and your customary fee.
That'll be 25 a day in expenses. 7 cents a mile for 23 miles, and, Oh, yeah, 35 cents for parking my car. Yeah,
7 times 23, $1.60, 61, 35...
$1.96. $26.96 altogether.
Is cash all right, I suppose?
Always has been.
Marlowe, I am sorry about this. I didn't set out to bring you on a wild goose chase. But yes, looks like I've got the right amount.
Thanks. Don't worry about it, Higgins. Anybody can change his mind.
Yes, I guess that's right. Well, thanks for your trouble.
Not at all. Eh, well.
Mr. Marlowe, wait!
I turned in the direction of a voice, but the fog has a cute way of diffusing sound as well as sight. And I realized I wasn't closing in on anything, that the fog was circling me and I was circling it. So I stopped and waited. I listened and heard nothing but the sound of the sea and the faint wheezing of the pike calliope. Then suddenly it hit me. Somewhere along the fog-swept beach, a girl had called my name. And nobody knew I was in Long Beach except Red at the parking lot and Dale Higgins. Yeah, the choice was obvious.
Did she find you okay, Mr. Marlowe?
Yeah, Red, she did. You tell her where I was?
Why, sure. I told her you and me always did our shooting at the Quick Quack.
Good boy. Now tell me who she is.
Who she is?
Yeah.
You mean you don't know her, Mr. Marlowe?
That's the general idea, Red.
Well, I guess she's my age.
This I know. Who is she?
She's...
Yeah.
She's... You want your car, Mr. Marlowe?
No, Red, not now. I think I left something back at the Quick Quack. Everything that was young and pretty along the pike was hanging onto a sailor's arm. Around Gene Arno's Quick Quack, the nearest thing to youth and beauty with a neatly lined 22s poised across the counter.
Try your luck, mister?
No, thanks.
Just lucky, not buying.
Yeah. See, I just lost my girl.
Well, don't blow your brains out here. These guns is for shooting ducks.
I see what you mean. We said we'd meet here if we got separated. Have you seen him by any chance?
She's 7-8 feet tall, glandular case. She's 3 stalls down, build with toothpick.
Thanks so much.
Still just looking, not buying.
Still just look...
Try it from a distance. It looks even better. Go on, bud. Beat it.
I spotted her. At least I'd spotted a frightened fawn of a thing who caught my eye as if we were the only two on the pike. And there was something about her that made me wish we were. I followed her away from the crowded amusement section up the ramp toward Ocean Boulevard. Suddenly, she broke into a run, darted into an alleyway. I wasn't far behind her.
No one saw you, did they? Follow me?
Like who?
He might have. And there may be others. I don't know.
That makes two of us. Now, wait a minute. Let's talk, huh?
I saw you meet him. I thought it was you at the parking lot. I saw you meet him at the ship's galley.
Something like you lost in a mob.
I'll kill you, you know. If you're with them, I'll kill you. I've got to before someone kills me. I don't know about you.
Now, listen, baby, I'm with you.
Don't come any nearer.
All right.
I can't be seen with you. I can't walk out of here with you. He's around somewhere. I know he is. Oh, Mr. Marlowe, you'll help me. You'll have to. There isn't anyone else.
Of course I will.
Well, then look. As soon as you can, get your car. Don't let Val see you now.
Val?
You know Val. Listen, in your car, meet me at 7th and Anaheim. I'll get there. I'll have to. And then we can talk.
Yeah, but wait a minute.
7th
Hold
and
it.
Anaheim, Mr. Marlowe. Oh, I'm Dale Higgins.
It was a study in contrast all the way. The din and kaleidoscope of Rainbow Pier against the lonely sound of a foghorn. The gray feel of fog and the dank gray black of the warehouse district at 7th and Anaheim. An urgent wire signed Dale Higgins. Dale Higgins. And a guy who called himself Higgins. Husband? Lover? What? Well, here we go again, Marlowe. I parked the car and waited. The fog hugged the streetlight, but the sign was intermittently visible. I had the right place. I don't know how long it was before I heard the footsteps, but it was long enough for me to stretch my legs out along the car seat, lean my head back against the door, and feel the damp touch of fog sweep against my face from an open window.
I remember starting to turn my head toward the direction of the steps and thinking that Dale had made it in good time.
Oh!
In just a moment, we will return to the second act of Philip Marlowe. But first, just as systematic exercise builds a strong body, so does systematic saving build a strong future. Save systematically for your future and for your country's future with United States Defense Bonds. And now with our star, Gerald Moore, the second act of Philip Marlowe, and tonight's story, A Seaside Sabbatical.
I could almost hear the chain pulleys clanking the first time I opened my eyes. And it took another game try before the fuzz faded away and the room slowed down to a Lambeth walk. Off somewhere, the faint sound of breakers. And I did the ceiling, the walls, and one corner of an expensively furnished room before I centered on the fuzzy, indeterminate face at my bedside. A kind face, motherly and pleasant. It talked.
I'm Mrs. Higgins.
Oh no.
Yes, I am.
Is everybody in Long Beach named Higgins?
You don't really feel a bit well, do you?
No, not really.
We're awfully sorry, Mr. Marlowe. I know when Dale realizes what she's done, she'll be sorry, too.
Yeah, I suppose. Dale bean me? What, with a peer?
She's often violent, I'm afraid. Such a high-strung girl. Gives way so easily, you know.
Yeah.
Imagines all sorts of things and then, well, just gives way.
Yeah.
But I won't worry you with that. Dale's my problem.
Uh-huh.
I won't worry you with anything, Mr. Marlowe. Just you get a nice rest.
I'm a cinch.
We'll pay whatever damages there are, of course. But I won't hear of you leaving now until you're much better.
Oh. Hey.
Oh.
The mother of the Higgins clan had locked the door and walked away. My head felt big and woozy and rammed down into my neck. I was not in the pink. Mother Higgins had ordered a nice rest, and it looked like I'd need it. But I don't like strange rooms and locked doors and high-strung girls who give way. I was still trying to get out of bed when another door clicked slowly open on the other side of the room. My little frightened fawn was back, and my head hurt.
I heard Marie with you. That's how I knew you were here. Oh, poor Mr. Marlowe. Did they hurt you?
They sure did.
It wouldn't do, you know, if they found me talking to you. I feel better now that you're here.
I wish I did.
What happened to you, do you know?
I have a rough idea. Say, honey, how much do you weigh?
105 when I left the convent, but that's not important. Listen, I can't stay long.
You know, a romance with you would be rough.
Please, Mr. Marlowe. They're going to kill me. Val and Marie, I...
All right. Now settle down.
They are, and I don't know why. Maybe if I knew why, I'd understand.
Yeah, but listen, I...
I didn't even know Val then.
Val?
Val Nichols, a friend of Marie's. She sent him to the boat to meet me, and ever since then, I just know they are going
to
kill me.
Dale, listen to me. I don't know Val. As a matter of fact, until you told me, I thought his name was Higgins, and I don't know Marie. But what makes you think they're going to kill you?
You met Val last night, the ship's galley. You talked to him. And Marie was just here. Oh, don't try to confuse me. You're all I have.
All right, honey, but tell me, isn't Marie your mother?
My stepmother. Daddy's dead. And when I got off the Orange Coast the other night, whenever it was, there was Val.
The Orange Coast?
That's how I came back. Mr. Marlowe, you're not trying to understand. If you won't help me, then... He's coming. Don't let him...
I hope that you're not bothering Mr. Marlowe, Dale.
No, I'm not. He asked me to come in. He likes me.
Of course he does, dear. We all do.
No.
Feeling better, Mr. Marlowe?
The worst way.
Oh, I'm sorry. Come, Dale. Let's let Mr. Marlowe rest. Oh, you could use a little rest yourself, my dear.
No. He wants me to stay. I'm not bothering.
Well, you're not bothering at all, honey, but maybe it would be better if you come back a little later.
Yes,
huh?
Yes. Of course it would, dear. Now, come along now.
I can come back, though, Mr. Marlowe. You promise?
Sure.
If you promise, I know you'll keep it. Never mind, Val. I came in alone, you know.
I can find my way out.
She's sweet. She's sick. A very sick young lady, Marlowe. Troubled, confused.
She's got nothing on me. Now, look, what is this all about? I don't know what day it is, what I'm doing here, who you are, anything.
Well, it should all have ended with our meeting at the ship's galley last evening, Marlowe.
You're not clearing anything up for me, you know.
You've seen her, talked to her. You must realize that she imagines things. Right now, she imagines that she's been away from here a long time, that she came back a few days ago upon a ship, that her mother and I want to kill her.
She did send me the wire, though.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, we had no idea one of her spells was coming on. We left her for a short time yesterday. The switchboard has its instructions, of course, and they reported it to Mrs. Higgins on your return. So we thought it best if I met you and...
Call me up.
It's not in your line, Marlowe.
You're right. I'm going to keep it that way, too.
Mrs. Higgins realizes that she's going to have to do something about Dale. Institution, perhaps. Some long-range treatment, at any rate. Dale was in no condition to be running around last night playing mysteries. Taking up your time.
Whoever hit me in the head last night was in pretty good condition.
If I had gotten there 2 minutes sooner, I could have spared you all that.
You were following her?
No. I was coming back from my boat. I had gone down to the harbor after I left you.
Oh.
Yes, on the way back, I just happened to see Dale, and knowing the state she was in, I followed her, of course.
I see. She doesn't know she hit me, does she?
I don't believe that she has the slightest idea what happened.
Things started swimming again. Val Nichols became part of the draperies. I was trying to think, but it hurt. Everything hurt. Next time I tried, I was more successful. The sunlight was streaming in the room. The clock on the night table, visible for the first time, said it was almost noon. So I got up. It was still pretty fuzzy on the edges, but I found my clothes hung neatly in the closet. Managed to get them on in the right order and made it to the door that had been locked before, but it wasn't this time.
Mr. Marlowe, you shouldn't be up.
Well, I'm always flying in the face of great odds, Mrs. Higgins, Bill's character.
Even so, you should stay in bed a while.
Oh, really, I'm fine, thanks.
But you're not leaving. I won't think of it. You'll lunch with us at least.
No, really. I've got to go, but I'd like to see Dale first. I sort of promised her I would.
Oh, my. She's sleeping, Mr. Marlowe.
Oh?
We gave her a sedative. Doctor's orders, of course. She's had such a trying time, you
know. I wouldn't want to disturb her, no. But maybe I can call later.
Oh, huh? That would be so thoughtful of you. I know she'll be disappointed at not seeing you, but I... Oh, Val, I...
Up and about so soon, Marlowe?
Yes,
She's sleeping, isn't she, Val? Hmm? The sedative and all. I mean, I was just telling Mr.
Marlowe... Oh, yes. She's resting very well, Marie. Now, don't fret about her. Well... I'll take you to your car, Marlowe.
Yes. Well, Mrs. Higgins, it's been...
It's been downright dreadful, and I know it, Mr. Marlowe. If I can do anything to right this terrible wrong, please let me know.
Well, if I can think of anything, I'll let you know. Goodbye, Mrs. Higgins. Tell Dale goodbye for me, will you?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course I will. Well, it looks like another lovely day, doesn't it?
I followed Val Nichols' lead to an elevator and for the first time discovered that I was in an apartment hotel on a different stretch of Ocean Boulevard than the one I'd grown to loathe the night before. Val filled in a few last details as he walked me to my car in the underground garage. Seems he'd driven Dale and me to the apartment from 7th and Anaheim in my car and sent a lackey back for his. It fit. We shook hands and that hurt my head too. I drove off. Somewhere in the harbor district, the need for coffee and a few lungful of ocean air forced my hand. I parked the car and found both in a ship-shaped spot with a clear view of the docks. The first cup cleared my head, and the second one darn near cleared the counter.
Hey, watch it!
I am. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. It'll wipe up. How about you, get any on you?
No, I don't think so. You know anything about ship schedules?
Like what?
Like that first one out there at anchor.
The Orange Coast?
Yeah.
Well, seems to me she landed 3 or 4 nights ago. Don't know how long she'll be tied up. She's a fruit boat, though. Their office is just a block from here.
Oh?
More than likely, they're booked solid, but if you want to check...
Yes,
Mr. Marlowe. There was a passenger Higgins on the Orange Coast when it docked Tuesday. Miss Higgins it was. Miss Dale Higgins, according to our records.
Any record of where she boarded the boat?
Let's see now. Oh, yes, at Macapa.
Macapa?
Brazil.
Macapa, Brazil. Was she traveling alone by any chance?
I really don't know. There's nothing here to...
Any other Higgins is aboard?
No.
How about a passenger named Nichols? Any chance of that?
No Nichols either.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks very much. It was my turn to send a wire, only it was a cable this time. And it was going to be a while between answers, so I checked into a nice, clean, inconspicuous hotel. Had some food and a half bottle of aspirin and placed two phone calls. Dale Higgins was still resting comfortably, according to her stepmother. But Muff Benjamin was still willing to do anything for a buck. He was there in no time.
I heard you were here, Marlowe. Something big.
Could be. You tell me, you're the guy who hears things.
About you being here? Mm-hmm. Well, you know how it goes. People see people tell people. It's nothing.
Yeah, I know. It happens all the time. Now, look, Muff, I gotta know things quick.
Well, I...
For money.
Who and what?
All right. I get this. The name is Higgins. Mm-hmm. Man old enough to have an 18-year-old daughter. I don't know his first name. He's dead, I think. But the daughter's name is Dale. You got that? And the wife that's surviving is called Marie. They have an apartment on Ocean Boulevard, the shore, I think it is.
I got it.
Okay. Now, a guy named Val Nichols. Check on him, too. If Higgins is dead, find out about a will.
I'm ahead of you.
Good. Get back as soon as you can, huh?
You double the dough, I'll double the speed.
You're double. Hello.
Mr. Philip Marlowe, please.
Speaking.
I have a reply to your cable to Macapa, Brazil.
Oh, good. Give it to me slow, huh?
Dale Higgins, accompanied to boat by nun.
Nun?
Order of the Holy Cross has convent near here. Suggest you check there. Signed, Emerson Ward, Macapa Fruit Exporting Company.
Did you say Order of the Holy Cross?
That's right. Do you wish to send a reply?
No. Oh, not yet, anyway. Thanks. So you see, Father, if you could help me contact the convent in Brazil, I could find out how long Dale was a student there. That might shed some light on the situation, huh?
I see. I'm not schooled in your ways, Mr. Marlowe. Still, we're both seekers after truth, aren't we? In this case, a very specific truth.
That's right, Father.
I want to help, of course. Your cable said this was a Sisters of the Holy Cross convent?
Yes. If there were any way we could call down there. You see, Father, time's pretty important.
If it's possible, we shall call, my son. Meanwhile, our prayers are with Miss Higgins. Come, Mr. Marlowe.
My prayers were with the phone company, too. And with Muff. And, of course, Dale. Because if her version of things were true, she was in real trouble. Until I knew what it was for, there was very little I could do for her.
Was the information from the sisters helpful, Mr. Marlowe?
Well, they were very cooperative, Father. Dale's been a student there for almost 7 years, winter and summer. Her stepmother visited her every day, but Dale never left the convent until 2 weeks ago. Maybe it all fits, huh?
I'll bless her, my son.
Thank you, Father. And thank the Sisters of the Holy Cross. Muff Benjamin was waiting at my hotel when I got back. It was another study in contrasts. So far, I dealt with a priest, an informer, and a sister superior. And together, we were all coming close to an answer.
His name was Dale Higgins, too, the doll's father. Died 7 years ago, loaded.
Yeah?
Left the second wife, Maria, good income. But the big load went to the kid.
All right, what'd you get on Val Nichols?
Oh, he's a bad one.
Yeah?
Specialty is knocking down rich widows. Currently fraternizing with this Marie Higgins thing.
Bless you, Muff.
Huh?
I mean, here's your dough.
You do look so much better than when you left, Mr. Marlowe.
Really? Is Dale still sleeping?
Why, yes.
I think I'll look in on her, huh?
No, I mean, I'd rather you didn't.
Where is she, Mrs. Higgins?
Mr. Marlowe, you have no...
I wonder if she liked it at the convent.
What?
7 years, a long time to be away from home. A lot of things can happen in 7 years, you know, Mrs. Higgins. You can even end up legally dead.
Why, I'm sure I don't have any idea.
Dale's dad must have thought a lot of her. I'll bet she was pretty close to him, too.
She was. Mr. Marlowe, what are you...
Do you tell me, Mrs. Higgins.
There's nothing to tell.
Dale seems to think there is. Which room is hers?
She isn't here. Oh, Mr. Marlowe, don't ask any more.
Oh, she's with Val, huh?
On his boat. Oh, how did this ever happen? I didn't want it this way. I thought if she could have been declared legally dead, oh, I'd have taken care of her. I mean, kept her there in the convent. No one knew she was there but Val.
Val had to have her really dead. Is that expensive, Mrs. Higgins?
Oh, help her, Mr. Marlowe. He'll do it this time. He'll kill her, I know. Believe me, I don't want
that. How long have they been gone?
Not long. Half an hour, maybe, but no longer. I'll go with you.
Marie really cracked on the way to the harbor. It was going to be a fishing accident in the channel. And Val would get away with it, too, unless we found something that could outpower his 30-footer. It was called the Queen Marie, one guess who had given it to him. I found the boat I needed, all right, but the skipper seemed reluctant to go for it.
Wildest thing I ever heard of.
I tell you, it's a matter of life and death.
The Coast Guard can't go on every...
Look, a month ago we needed you off Balboa when our motor conked out and you came.
But we've received no distress call from the Queen Marie.
What do you think this is I'm giving you?
Please, don't waste time talking.
All right, come on, how about it?
Okay, but if this isn't on the level, you're in some trouble, Marlowe.
By the time we'd cleared the harbor, I knew Val didn't have a chance. Every boat in the area had been alerted. I didn't know about Dale, though. I just hoped the sedative Val had given her was merciful. The Coast Guard took care of Val once we came alongside the Queen Marie, and I took care of Dale. She was in the galley, tied securely. Still dopey, but she came around after a while.
Oh, Mr. Marlowe, you...
Take it easy, baby. You're okay.
You... I was afraid you'd forgotten the promise.
No.
But you didn't, did you?
It was night now. The lights that stretched out along the shore looked friendly and warm. Friendly and warm. I wonder when people are going to realize that the only happiness there is in the world is what they can give each other. Happiness, that is. Not a stab in the back. But you know, there's one thing about me. Yeah, I have to admit it. I'm an optimistic fella.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, bringing you Raymond Chandler's most famous character, star Gerald Moore, are produced and directed by Norman MacDonald and written for radio by Kathleen Height. Featured in the cast were Gene Bates, John Daner, Irene Tedrow, and Lee Millar, with Harry Bartell, Barney Phillips, Lou Krugman, Donna Hayner, and Stan Waxman. Gerald Moore may soon be seen in the Santana production, Sirocco. The special music is composed by Pierre Garrigank, and conducted by Wilbur Hatch. Be sure to listen again next week at the same time when Philip Marlowe says...
This time an old lady got taken for a new kind of ride by a new kind of chauffeur, and I got involved up to a gun in my ribs, all because I decided to spend a quiet day at home.
Don't miss Broadway's My Beat, featuring Detective Danny Clovers, the cop who knows every character, every star, every crook frequenting the Great White Way. It's tomorrow night at the Star's address. Now, stay tuned for Gangbusters, which follows immediately over most of these same CBS stations. This is Roy Rowan speaking. This is CBS. Hear Horace Hyde every Sunday night, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That's Case Closed for this week. Hope you liked it. You can find more from Marlowe and Holmes at RelicRadio.com alongside past episodes of Case Closed. and all the other shows. You can find our Shoutcast stream there and our donate button if you'd like to help support this and all the shows. My thanks, as always, to those who have, and thanks for joining me today. Talk to you again next Wednesday with another episode of Case Closed.